Sunset Hues and Shimmer of Strings, ending the Violin Concerto from 1916 by Frederick Delius, which you've just heard performed live here at the BBC Proms by one of the works and the composer's most ardent champions, Tasmin Little, with the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Vasily Petrenko. The first time Tasmin and Vasily have worked together, but she has a long relationship with the Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra. She was telling us, going back to her first professional appearance with them in May 1985 in this very concerto in Bradford, Delius's Yorkshire birthplace. Back they come onto the platform. Tasmin, well, she's shimmering, really. She's wearing a reddish gold sleeveless dress with a bronze-coloured demi-train or fishtail. We couldn't decide what to call it when she was describing it earlier, so take your pick. Petrenko bringing the orchestra onto their feet, grasping Tasmin Little's left hand in his own and raising it. She's smiling and her thanks across every member of this audience here. The violin, by the way, she made a new recording of the Delius Concerto for this 150th anniversary year on her own Guadagnini, but this evening she's brought the Strad, the Regent Stradivari from 1708, which is on loan to her from the Royal Academy of Music's instrument collection. And as well as her appearance in the unforgettable Wallace and Gromit prom earlier this season, Tasmin's been in Wales recently in the USA, and she's just got back from a two-week tour in Australia and Tasmania. She comes across and shakes the hand of Thelma Handy, the orchestra's leader. They're all applauding her now as she bows once again to the promenaders. She's going to be in the recording studio in September. Word is it's going to be another British concerto she's recording this time, and she's preparing a recital of British violin music to record in the autumn as well. And she's going to be playing the Brahms Concerto at Cadogan Hall in London on the 21st of September. I should point out that there's more Delius at the Proms. The Proms Family Orchestra and Northern Sinfonia on hearing First Cuckoo in Spring. I think that's on Monday. Well, the second half of this evening's BBC Prom brings us music by a composer with whom Vasily Petrenko and his Liverpool Orchestra have been carving out quite a reputation, Dmitri Shostakovich, his 10th symphony. And Petrenko will be sharing his reflections on the work and its Soviet background before we hear it. But we're not breaking the Delius connection just yet, as you're about to find out. It's time to join Matthew Sweet and his guests for this evening's Proms Plus literary event, recorded earlier at the Royal College of Music, just over the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Hello. Tonight, the Albert Hall resounds to Delius and Shostakovich, but they've played bigger spaces than that. How about the imagination of Ken Russell, a place in which the great composers own harpsichords that spit fire, where showgirls ride the wings of giant biplanes, and where Catherine Oxenberg hangs in her pants above the lair of the white worm. A place which, since Russell's death in November, now only exists in his films. In this programme, we'll explore that place with two people who knew him well. Glenda Jackson, who took direction from him over the course of the decades, from Women in Love and The Music Lovers to The Rainbow and Salome's Last Dance. And the film critic Mark Kermode, a tireless advocate of Russell's work and responsible for healing the cuts sometimes inflicted upon it by the censors. OK, well, let's deal with perhaps a slightly tricky issue at the start. Ken Russell once said, "I think people are afraid to employ me. They think I'm uncontrollable and unbankable, but my imagination is uncontrollable." Is that the right way to characterise him, Glenda Jackson?
I think it would do a disservice to his actual professionalism in a curious way. There wasn't anything on a film set that he couldn't operate. He didn't always operate it at the same time, at the right time, but nonetheless, his actual knowledge of the technical aspects of filmmaking was comprehensive. And he was absolutely concentrated on the work. But he certainly did have a third eye, and he certainly did create, certainly speaking from a selfish point of view as an actress, create the climate in which I could do my work.
How controllable did producers find him, Mark?
Well, I mean, the story is, as he told it, he was thought of as uncontrollable, but Glenda's absolutely right. You don't make films like a musical like The Boyfriend, or, you know, a rock musical like Tommy, or an extraordinary historical epic like The Devils, or a science fiction movie like Altered States without understanding technically how things work on set. I mean, I was never on set with him, but I've interviewed loads of people who work with him, and they all said the same thing, which was that what you need during any of those productions is a single voice, somebody who will listen to the suggestions of those around them, but in the end is steering the ship, a captain. You know, people describe film sets as being like a boat on the brink of mutiny, and it's the director's job to bring it safely home. He did that time and time again, and no matter how unruly his imagination, no matter how imaginative he could be, he understood the nuts and bolts. You do not make that filmography without the attention to detail that he had.
And he also brought them in on time and on budget.
And on budget, yeah.
That fear that he alluded to was presumably a producer's fear. But what was the actor's attitude to him?
Oh, well, we loved him. I mean, it was just so wonderful to work on a film of his. He didn't direct us. I mean, like all great directors, he knew what he didn't want and was open to suggestion as to what he did. But he never directed. I mean, he would come up to me and he'd say, oh, it's a bit... it needs to be a bit more... And you knew exactly what he meant. And I think... I did. We all did. And I think Liv Ullmann sort of, for me, crystallised what I'm trying to express. She was saying that in a film that she did with Bergman, the scene was she had to walk down a corridor. There was nobody else in the scene. She didn't have a line of dialogue, and she was playing a very vain woman. And so every reflecting surface that she passed, she checked her appearance. And he'd set up the camera to catch it if she did it. And she did it. And that's what I mean with Ken. He could create the climate in which you could do what you could do.
There were certain risks associated with working with him, though, weren't there?
He's like
physical
a lot of,
risks,
yeah,
perhaps.
Like a lot of very good directors. They prove how brave they are by putting their actors through really death-defying incidents. and yes, he did. I mean, but you learnt very quickly never to complain. I can remember on The Music Lovers there was a dream sequence, and the whole cast is appearing in a nightmare for Tchaikovsky. So we all rush out in our period costumes, and he'd got this wind machine, which is actually the propeller from an aeroplane. Fortunately, it's in a cage, but anyway. So we run out and literally were blown off our feet, and I was first out, so I was on the bottom of the pile. So people were being picked up off me, and eventually and he's standing just by my head. And I looked up at him and I said, that was the most fantastic experience of my life, the closest to flying I've ever come. He said, turn the effing wind machine down. Now, if I got up and said, what do you think you're doing? Do you want to kill me? How can I work like this? He'd have said, bring two more wind machines onto the set. I can remember once saying to Christopher Gable, why does he never say cut? And Chris said, because he never knows what you're going to do. And so he gave that space to actors, and if there were something was coming out that, you know, he could use, he'd use it.
Did the private man fit the public persona, you know, the eternal enfant terrible, the mischief maker?
Well, I think that's a great misrepresentation of him. He was an intensely shy and astonishingly sensitive man. And yet, if you treated him as though he was a fool, he would be the greatest fool the world had ever seen. If you thought he was an enfant terrible, he'd break up the room for you. A lot of that was, I think, a carapace to protect what he knew was important in him, and that was his genius.
Can we sketch in a bit of his background, Mark? He was born in Southampton. His father ran a shoe shop.
Yeah, I mean, importantly, you know, he grew up fascinated by this. I mean, one of the things we should talk about, because we're essentially talking about music here, is he did not grow up, at least according to his account, surrounded by classical music. Mm-hmm. He tells this absolutely entrancing story of the first time he experienced what he thought of as classical music, was that he heard something on the radio, and he was completely transfixed by it, and he waited till the end of it to get the name of it. And the way he describes it, he got on his bicycle, pumped up the tires of his bicycle, drove down to the local record store and said, have you got this piece of music? And they went, yep, sure, and they sold it to him, and it was 6 discs, 78. He went home, played it, was overwhelmed, rushed back to the store and said, is there more like this? And the guy turned to the rest of us and went, well, there's all of this. And then he told another story about the first time he ever heard Rites of Spring. And he said he heard Rites of Spring, I think it was on the radio, and he said, and I did what every sane person would have done. And I said, what was that? He said, I took off all my clothes and I danced naked around the living room. And I said, did you really do that? And he looked at me like I was bonkers and said, well, who wouldn't? And in a way, the most extraordinary thing about him is, for somebody who had such an intuitive knowledge and at the end such an encyclopedic knowledge of music, mm-hmm. was not raised in that tradition. One of the great triumphs of what he did was he believed that music was for everybody, whether it's rock music, folk music, sea shanties, which he loved, classical music, you know, opera, whatever it was, he believed that it was for everybody because he had come to it all as a sort of, you know, as an untutored ear. And he would close his eyes and see these pictures, which then eventually became his films, first through his music documentaries and those then for his feature films. And his main idea was, this is for everyone, and I know because I wasn't schooled in it, and yet I get it.
His early career, Mark, takes us back to that rather odd moment when making arts documentaries for the BBC was somehow an entree into the movie business.
Yes. Well, it was extraordinary. I mean, he talks about his very early career. Obviously, he made short films like Amelia and the Angel. He talked very passionately about, you know, his conversion to Catholicism, which he described as turning on a light. Of course, he was a dancer. I mean, people don't remember this, but he did actually dance. And he what he wanted to do with his music documentaries was to express the way he responded to this music, but within a documentary format that broke the documentary format. Now, obviously, when he started, were very strict rules about what you could and couldn't do in depicting the lives of artists. And Ken was always pushing at the boundaries of this. In a way, that's how that early monitor work, that early arts program stuff, feeds into his feature films, things like, for example, The Music Lovers and Mahler and Listomania at the very far end of the spectrum. But with all of them, what he was doing was attempting to dramatize the pictures that he said. I mean, people have used the word synesthesia in connection with Ken, that he would hear music visually. But he was doing it within these very strict confines of what you could and couldn't do in the depiction of an artist's life. And, of course, at times, it caused outrage. You know, when he was making films about Strauss, there were questions in the house. When he was making films about Mahler, there was great controversy about this. But I think what he was always trying to do was to show the audience what was in his head and then tie it back to... It was still documentary, but you watch those films, they are documentaries, but they're poetry, they're visual poetry, they're musical poetry that has a documentary basis.
But also, he, I think, was in a way seminal in bursting many of the pretensions that surround great artists or great genius. I mean, the idea, you know, that they're not human beings, that they have a direct sort of phone line to God, and all they have to do is wait for the genius to come down, and the work is there. And he was absolutely, I thought, brilliant in debunking all that fantasy about what it's like to be a creative artist, because you're under the lash all the time if you're a creative artist. It's no fun at all. I mean, it must be absolutely terrible to be burdened with genius in that way.
Is this what he was doing in The Music Lovers, his Tchaikovsky film? He pitched that to the studio as, it's the story of the marriage between a homosexual and a nymphomaniac. Glenda, you were that nymphomaniac.
I was, indeed, yeah. Yes, I mean, that's, you know, we're talking now about the creative thing, but the other point I think one has to make is that it was, and I think still remains, very difficult to get a film financed, and it doesn't really matter. I can remember John Schlesinger saying to me, I said, where have you been? He said, I've been tap dancing around America trying to raise money for a film. And that was also part and parcel of what, you know, a director had to do, and I think that was something that Ken certainly didn't enjoy.
Was there a sort of musical rhythm to his films, Glenda? I'm thinking that, I mean, in The Music Lovers, I think one of my favourite edits in Ken Russell's body of work is that scene where you are walking along the street and saying to Richard Chamberlain Tchaikovsky, well, we'll go on a long train journey, we'll have a nightcap and we'll have a good night's sleep, cut to you glugging back the champagne in that railway carriage that then begins rocking around all over the place.
Well, I personally, but it's not, wasn't something that I felt when we were actually shooting, but when you saw the films all put together, there always did seem to me to be an intensely musical element. I don't just mean the sound, I mean the kind of rhythms and the colorations of the scenes actually playing out. But we shot that scene and he realized he needed another shot, so he said to me, they built this railway carriage. And we had to come back, and it was me rolling naked on the floor of the railway carriage, and the cameraman and the operator were in the luggage rack, and I'm rolling around. And he was somewhere, Ken was somewhere. And he'd been playing music, and he said, shall I cut the music? So I said, no, don't cut the music. I said, no, I need that. That's great, because the carriage was being manually rocked. And I can't remember the piece. I mean, Mark said he thought it was from The Fiery Angel.
I thought it was Prokofiev,
yeah. I can't remember that. But as I said, you know, if I'd been humming Gershwin, he'd have played Gershwin for me if that had been really what he wanted. But it was, there I am rolling around. The first thing that happened was all the champagne bottles and the glass and the thing crash onto me. Oh, he says, she's fine, she's not bleeding much. Come on, she's not bleeding, it'll never show. So the next thing is there was some beautiful period luggage on the other luggage rack, which was metal, hat boxes. They're the next thing, bang, onto me. The bruises won't show, come on. So we get to the third time, and the next moment is the cameraman is sitting in my lap, and he said to me, I'm a married man. Quite what he thought I was going to do, I don't know, but... But that again, I mean, the kind of rocking of the carriage backwards and forwards, yes, there was a musical element to that.
He saw an overlap between the world of the contemporary rock music of the 1970s, yeah, and the classical composers. So sort of continuity between those two things.
He absolutely did. I mean, if you look at something like Tommy, which pretty much defined what we now think of as the pop video, what he did was he listened to that piece of music, which, oddly enough, the story of Tommy chimed very much with the story that he'd been writing anyway about false idolatry, which was always a big theme of his. You see it in many of his films. And he listened to it and responded to that in exactly the same way that he'd responded to the classical music that had inspired him before. And what's extraordinary about Tommy is it's like the birth of the rock video. It comes fully formed. There's no sense in Tommy that somebody's discovering a new... It's just like, this is it. And it's amazing now when you look at so much MTV and you just go, OK, that's a shot from Tommy, that's a shot from Listomania, that's a shot from... I mean, literally, in those two films, he defined what would then, you know, 30 years later, would still be ringing true. And I think one of the reasons is that he didn't see, this is classical music, this is serious, this is rock music, it's serious. I mean, obviously, Pete Townsend is a very versatile musician anyway, and he and Pete Townsend did get on very, very well. But he didn't see there as being a gap between the two things. They were all part of a continuum. And I think that also feeds into the fact that, you know, later in life he was making his short films, his experimental short films, and one of the things he was doing at one point was making a film in which he was trying to document all the verses of the sea shanty, "'Twas on the Good Ship Venus." This was a great passion for him. He loved sea shanties. They were all part and parcel of the same thing. It's all music, no matter what you call it, rock, pop, classical, it's all music.
His career does have a strange sort of symmetry to it, doesn't it? He makes his experimental, his student films, he makes films in Britain, he goes to Hollywood, he comes back, he makes films here again, and then in the last few years of his life, he's making films sort of out of the shed, isn't he? I mean, are we wrong to see this as a story of a rise and fall? Is that too simple a way of looking at it?
I think it is somewhat too simplistic. I mean, the real point of that story is it is to the undying shame of the British film industry that he was making films in a shed at the bottom of his garden, and the way that, in a sense, he has almost been sidelined. The man who transformed the British film industry, in my view. I mean, up until Ken came along, really, we were still stuck with that terrible, parochial, narrow vision of, I think in a way, a narrow vision of the country, but certainly a narrow view of what film was all about. And he absolutely exploded that. And people, you know, jumped on that bandwagon for a time, but in a way, the fact that he was making films in the shed in his bottom of his garden, it goes back to the point I was making earlier, that terrible, terrible burden of being whipped by your genius, which he was.
But did he really mind being in the shed, Mark? I mean, I remember going down to interview him And he spoke of his studio years almost as a sort of blip. And he said he hadn't enjoyed... He was making a film called Lion's Mouth, yeah. A sort of a kind of musical biopic of the rector of Stewkey, a sort of scandalous figure of the 1920s and 30s. And he said he hadn't enjoyed himself as much since he made Amelia and the Angel, that very early experimental film.
The peculiar thing is, when we were working on the restoration of The Devils, the uncut version of which still has not been released by Warners, because even after all these years, they still consider it too controversial, too fiery for public consumption. But even when he was doing that, he was making what he referred to as his garagiste films. He said, I'm a garagiste, I make films in my garage. And what he loved about it was the control. Not having to do the tap dancing around the producers, not having to fight the battles, he felt like that was a great freedom. And I think he genuinely enjoyed that work and produced some extraordinary work during that period as much as he enjoyed doing anything else. I completely agree with Glenda that it is outrageous the way that the British film industry didn't show him the respect it should have done. I mean, Fellini once described himself, to Ken, in fact, he said, here in Italy, they call me the Italian Ken Russell. Absolutely. You know, if Fellini was making films in his garage, they'd be having film festivals for it. Absolutely. They'd be, you know, celebrating him as the great maestro. Only here could... It wasn't that Ken was making films in his garage. It was that anybody didn't think that's the most brilliant thing and we must all see what he's been doing because it's Ken Russell.
What would the world have been like if Ken Russell had never been in it? What has he bequeathed us?
Well, I think Glenda is absolutely right that he transformed the British film industry. You know, he called it one of his books, you know, British Picture, and it was a reference to something his mother would say. Is it a British picture? Meaning, you know, is it small and about people making tea? And
exactly.
And he made movies that were classically not British. And they were, absolutely. You know, as you were saying, the big canvas, the big picture. So I think he gave us that. He had the air of a star as a director. I mean, people nowadays... There's a famous truism, apparently, that if you ask people to name movie stars, they can do it. But if you ask them to name movie directors, they go Steven Spielberg, Stanley Kubrick, Alfred Hitchcock. He was one of those flamboyant directors who you knew, you recognised his vision. He had, everything he touched had his touch on it. And I think even more than that, and I do think this is his enduring legacy, he was somebody who believed absolutely in the power of the work. And no matter what criticism was thrown at him, no matter what snipes were thrown at him by the critical establishment, no matter what financial difficulties he may have had, he never, ever, ever lost faith in the truth of the work. He passionately believed in his films and he passionately believed in cinema. And, I mean, I think that's his enduring legacy. He was an artist. He was an artist working in an industry.
Absolutely. And he never cheated. And he never lied, and he struggled, as all great artists do, to tell the truth in a medium which is quite difficult to tell the truth in quite often. And I go back to the point I was making earlier. I mean, of his BBC films, as I've said, my favourite is Isadora. I think Vivian Pickles is absolutely superb in it, but it's a superb film because it tells the truth about what it's like to be a performing artist, because he cuts away all the fantasy and all the romanticism. And he does that, I think, in all his films. And they are not only informed by the passion for the work, but something which I don't think has been recognized sufficiently in him. He was passionate about man's inhumanity to man. He was absolutely apoplectic about how dreadful we can be to each other. And that is in all his films somewhere.
And if I may add to that, that is at the core of The Devils,
absolutely.
Which was given a terrible run, but is, as far as he's concerned, a film about exactly that
absolutely.
Subject.
Absolutely.
Mark Kermode, Glenda Jackson, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Matthew Sweet presented this evening's Proms literary event on the work of director Ken Russell, and the producer was Gavin Hurd. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. I'm Andrew McGregor, live at the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's visit from the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra and its chief conductor, Vasily Petrenko, with whom they've been making something of a speciality of Shostakovich's symphonies, on disc and in concert. Now, the whole of the second half of the Prom is taken up with Shostakovich's 10th symphony, the first of the cycle to emerge after Joseph Stalin's death in 1953, and for many commentators, its four movements are inescapably associated with Shostakovich's experience of the Stalin years, the terrors and the purges. But what about Petrenko? Like Shostakovich, he was born, brought up and studied in Leningrad.
Yes, I always felt very close to his music. It's in my veins, it's in my blood, and when I'm conducting it, and I'm conducting it a lot now on the West, I always have pictures in my imagination of Leningrad as it's been by then. Of course, the city's changed now in a good side because it's cleaner, safer, etc. But it's lost its character a little bit. And all those periods in the history, all throughout the life of Shostakovich, are very fascinating. And how he have written the symphonies and had written basically autobiopic over 60 years is fascinating, and it's absolutely unprecedented.
And when it comes to the cycle of the symphonies, what do you think is the place of the 10th symphony, musically speaking? It's a very considerable moment
in the
cycle.
It's one of the most popular symphonies in the world. It's one of the most playable symphonies. And of course, it's a great music and one of the symphonies which shaped in very fascinating way. So you can see the architecture of the symphony clearly done. There's similarity in the structure of the movements. There's similarity in the relations between the themes, between the subjects, between first and third movement, for instance. The language is very different. Very meditative first movement and very grotesque, sardonic third movement. But relation between the themes are nearly the same, and the shape, the amount of time spent on exploration of one theme or another. It's also have fantastic orchestral colorings. There's some things which he found in this symphony which never happened before. Technique of the strings playing. It's the symphony which has probably most down bows alongside of all his symphonies. And they're quite fast passages which he insisted to play down bow because he wanted the special sound.
And what about this orchestra? Are they playing like Russians yet?
Of course they do. You know, what I like in Liverpool is that they do have some influence of Russian character, of course. But they also have the British character, of course. And combination of two, that's something very unique. I must say, in many ways, the British passion in the character is very close to the Russian passion in the character. It has no boundaries when it goes to the point. But it has its discipline, sometimes more than the Russian orchestra. It has its nobility, which also not always happened in the Russian orchestra. So I would say it's a combination of two countries or two characters from different countries, which makes it very unique.
That's Ilya Petrenko on his favourite Russian orchestra in the UK, the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic, which is on stage at the Royal Albert Hall right now. And here he comes, Petrenko, who's been reminding them all earlier today of life in Leningrad in the 1950s. And he's about to conduct Shostakovich's 10th symphony.